21st century renaissance of interest in Thomas Brown seems to be continuing, thanks to your attendance today. I'm going to talk about Brown's relationship to psychology. Dr. Brown remains a complex person to understand, not only because his prose demands several readings, but also because of the sheer diversity of his interests. Extremely devout and religious, he also conducted scientific experiments in his laboratory. He was a lover of nature, especially birds and botany. A collector of coins and antiquities, he was a scholar who was also well versed in Latin, Greek, and Hebrew, as well as several modern languages. He had a fertile imagination, as well as a subtle sense of humour. A collector of books, he was a voracious reader, blessed with a capacious and retentive memory. Brown was also fascinated with all kinds of hidden, secret forms of knowledge. Egyptian hieroglyphs, codes and anagrams, ancient Greek oracles, physiognomy, the Kabbalah, as well as astrology and alchemy, all held interest to him. Because of his many interests, Thomas Brown is often defined these days as a polymath. However, I believe there's a closer fitting definition of him, one which is tailor-made for him and his medical profession, that of early or proto-psychologist. He certainly was one who observed and studied humanity deeply in order to philosophize upon the theater of ourselves, as he puts it. To my mind, there's four distinct elements to Brown's proto-psychology, all of which are interrelated to each other. The first two, his capacity for self-analysis and his interest in people, were integral to his life. The second pair, his usage of proper name symbolism and fascination with dreams, are enduring elements of his proto-psychology. After we've looked at each of these elements, I'll then explain how Brown's proto-psychology influenced one of the founding fathers of the modern science of psychoanalysis. Brown's life spanned the greater part of the 17th century, and one useful generalisation about the 17th century is of a century which opens, predominantly religious, but which closes, firmly scientific in outlook. This fundamental shift in the focus and priority of Western consciousness from the rule of religion to the ascendancy of science gathered pace in Brown's lifetime. It was also the century which saw scientific instruments developed which continue to assist our understanding of ourselves, nature, and the universe to the present day, the microscope and the telescope. When Brown arrived in Norwich in 1637, it was England's second city, and it enjoyed strong links in trade, transport, and culture to Europe. A visitor picturesquely described it as either a city in an orchard or an orchard in a city. So equal are houses and trees blended in it. Norwich was also a city in need of good doctors. As the home to a wealthy gentry who could afford a doctor's fee, it was the ideal place for a newly qualified doctor to establish a medical practice. Brown wrote his Religio Medici, or The Religion of a Doctor, before arriving in Norwich, but an authorised version of it wasn't published until several years later. Now, Religio Medici is a bold literary experiment, a pioneering self-portrait which was unprecedented in English literature. His frank display of his spiritual beliefs, inner world, and opinions became a controversial bestseller. When it was translated into French and Dutch, it gave him European fame. Religio Medici continues to be a classic of world literature, not least for its author's charity, goodwill, and tolerance towards others. Only, it isn't all goodwill and tolerance. Brown's in-depth analysis includes some quite dramatic expressions of psychological anguish as the young doctor discovers self-examination isn't always a comfortable experience. I feel sometimes a hell within myself. Lucifer keeps his court in my breast. Legion is revived in me. 'Tis that unruly regiment within me that will destroy me. 'Tis I that do infect myself. The man without a navel yet lives in me. I feel that original canker corrode and devour me. Lord, deliver me from myself. Brown discusses a wide variety of topics in Religio Medici, but it may also be the case, as one critic realised, Brown is his own fascinating subject, and he knows it. In one of the most famous passages of Religio Medici, Brown leaps in thought from women to beauty to love and cosmic harmony, like this. I speak not in prejudice against the fair sex, nor am averse, but am naturally amorous of all that is beautiful. I can look a whole day with delight upon a handsome picture, though it be but of a horse. It is my temper, and I like it the better to effect all harmony. For sure, there is music even in the silent note which Cupid strikes, far sweeter than the sound of an instrument. For there is a music wheresoever there is harmony, order, or proportion. And thus far we may maintain the music of the spheres. Thomas Brown also had a deep interest in people, especially his patients. His interest in people is another vital source of his proto-psychology, and in his notebooks he records a case in Norwich of alcohol abuse. Robert Hutchinson at the Wheatsheaf in St. Peter's in Norwich drank a gallon of brandy, burnt and sweetened in the month of June 1675 in the space of 14 hours. He drank it hot, fell into a fever, and complained of an extraordinary burning in his stomach, but recovered in 7 days with a great loathing of brandy afterwards. He is aged 56. Even when Brown was getting on in years, when he was asked for help, he dutifully travelled all the way to Yarmouth in a case, an early case of the eating order, bulimia. There is a woman now living in Yarmouth named Elizabeth Mitchell, 102 years old, a person of 4 foot and a half high, very lean, very poor, and living in a mean room without ordinary accommodation. Her youngest son is 45 years old, and though she answers well enough to ordinary questions, yet she conceives her eldest daughter to be her mother. But what is remarkable in her is a kind of bulim, or dog, appetite. She greedily eating day and night all that her allowance, friends, and charitable people afford her, drinking beer or water, and making little distinction of any food, either of broths, flesh, fish, apples, pears. She sleeps indifferently well until hunger awakes her, and then she must have no ordinary supply, whether in the day or night. Brown must have been preparing notes and references for his encyclopedia, known as Pseudodoxia Epidemica, for several years before it was published in 1646. Its Latin title might loosely be translated as Pandemic of Fake News. And in it, he ranges through the time-honoured ladder of creation, from the mineral to vegetable to animal, man, art, geography, and finally the universe, addressing and challenging the many superstitions and mistakes of his time. Brown's scientific thinking was influenced by the natural philosophy of Francis Bacon, Indeed, the very opening lines of his encyclopedia repeat, almost word for word, an essay by Bacon. Bacon is famous for promoting scientific experimentation as a way of glorifying God. He's also remembered for conducting an experiment which ended badly. In an early experiment in food refrigeration, he stuffed a dead chicken with snow, caught pneumonia, and died. Brown's investigation of how the bird, known as the bittern, makes its booming call is a good example of how he went about eradicating common mistakes. He seems to have cared for feathered creatures better than Bacon and simply acquired a bittern, put it in his yard, kept his ears and eyes open as to how exactly it made its booming sound. As a bird fancier, it's recorded that at one time or another, he kept an owl, a cormorant, and even an eagle. The fact that Brown cared for such untamed birds suggests he was sensitive to living creatures, and he seems to have acted as a magnet for anything unusual found in Norfolk, whether bird or fish, bones or coins. When it was too large to be sent to him, such as a report of several whales stranded on the beach of the North Norfolk coast, he rode out on his horse to investigate. Throughout Pseudodotsica, Brown relies upon the triple alliance of reason, experience, or ocular observation, and the authority of the past. Pseudodotsica is Brown's major contribution to the 17th century scientific revolution, and it introduced many new words useful for scientific inquiry, such as electricity. With its short essay-like chapters and frequent humour, Pseudodotsica is probably the most accessible and certainly the most entertaining of all Brown's literary works. I like to sometimes think of him as some kind of Norfolk version of Don Quixote. Mounted in the saddle of his trusty steed, named Ocular Observation, armed with his lance of reason, he jousts and tilts at the windmills of superstition, whilst defending himself with the battered shield of the authorities consulted in his library. Norwich wasn't much disturbed by the events of the English Civil War. However, there were two events which no one living in the city could have failed not to notice. The ransacking and general trashing of the cathedral by supporters of the Puritan cause in 1643, and the so-called Great Blast of 48, an event which happened only a stone's throw from where we're sitting. It was during a short-lived royalist uprising that an ammunition store on Bethel Street, which was stocked full of barrels of gunpowder, was raided. Somehow or another, an accidental fire started, which then ignited the gunpowder, resulting in a great blast. The powerful explosion is estimated to have killed over 70 people. The English Civil War ended with the defeat of the Royalists and the execution of King Charles I. And these events may have prompted Brown, like other Royalists, to keep his head well down, socialise less, and retreat into a private world of books. The decade of the 1650s is quite unique in English history, and it saw a relaxing of censorship and a general liberalisation of printing laws. And in consequence, the greatest volume of esoteric literature ever published in England occurred. It would have been impossible for a book lover such as Brown not to have known of this publication trend. And in fact, a number of esoteric titles from this decade are listed as ones in his library. The catalogue of Sir Thomas Brown and his elder son Edward's combined libraries is an invaluable document for the study of Brown. However, a facsimile of the catalogue wasn't published until 1986, and thus it's only relatively recently that the contents of Brown's library have been widely known. The catalogue lists over 1,000 books, including half a dozen by one of Brown's favourite authors. Athanasius Kircher was Brown's near-exact contemporary. Born in Germany, Kircher was a Jesuit priest who studied ancient world artifacts, translated archaic languages, and conducted experiments in optics and magnetism. Kircher lived in Rome, which at the time was the centre of a worldwide network of Jesuit missionaries. And through the Jesuits' global missionary projects, he enjoyed receiving frequent, detailed reports of the geography, culture, and religions of countries as far away as Java, Peru, and China. Kircher believed Egyptian paganism was the source of virtually all beliefs, whether Greek, Roman, Chaldean, or even Japanese, Aztec. His most famous work, Oedipus Egypticus, or the Egyptian Oedipus, is a vast work of comparative religion, published in 3 volumes, each of which is the size of a flat-screen television. Oedipus Egypticus is a triumph of printing. It's over 2,000 pages in length, and it took 5 years to collate, finally published in 1656. In Oedipus Egypticus, Kircher explores the esoteric traditions of Zoroaster, Orpheus, Pythagoras, Plato, and although he's now known to have been wildly mistaken in almost all of his theories, nonetheless, he paved the way for future studies in comparative religion. It's interesting to note in passing that this favourite author of Brown's has been defined as the supreme representative of Hermeticism within post-Reformation Europe. Brown was an avid collector of Kircher's books, and his books on magnetism, optics, ancient Egypt, underground geography, and China were all once in his library. He respected him enormously and declared him to be an eminent example of industrious learning. Brown believed so much everything that Kircher said that when Kircher claimed that the music which he had notated from Sicilian peasants, when it was performed in conjunction with the tarantula dance, it was capable of curing those who had been bitten by a spider. It's against the background of great anxiety about England's future that in 1658, Brown published 2 slender essays, both of which cater for readers of the time. Urn Burial is a literary monument to the many lives lost in the English Civil War. The Garden of Cyrus caters for the enormous interest in esoteric topics which thrived throughout this uncertain decade. Inspired by the accidental discovery of Saxon funerary urns, Urn Burial opens with Brown's characteristic dry humour. He urges his reader to look beyond the surface of appearance. In the deep discovery of the subterranean world, a shallow part would satisfy some enquirers. The subterranean world which Brown explores in Urn Burial are the rituals, customs, and beliefs surrounding death and the afterlife. The unknowingness of the human condition is illustrated with some very vivid medical imagery. A dialogue between 2 infants in the womb concerning the state of this world might handsomely illustrate our ignorance of the next, whereof methinks we yet do dwell in Plato's den, and are but embryon philosophers. Brown's proto-psychology now extends itself to the relationship between memory and pain. We slightly remember our felicities, and these smartest strokes of affliction leave but short smart upon us. Sense endureth no extremities, and sorrows destroy us or themselves. To be ignorant of evils to come, and forgetful of evils past, is a merciful provision in nature. It's also in Urn Burial that Brand's solitary scientific discovery is recorded. Adipocere is a waxy fat which forms on the flesh of dead bodies under certain conditions. The music of Brand's full organ stop prose is heard to good effect at the apotheosis of Urn Burial. But man is a noble animal, splendid in ashes and pompous in the grave, solemnizing nativities and deaths with equal lustre, nor omitting ceremonies of bravery in the infamy of his nature. Life is a pure flame, and we live by an invisible sun within us. Published with Urn Burial, and quite different to it, the discourse The Garden of Cyrus has been called the ultimate test of one's response to Brown. Its opening page features half a dozen themes associated with Western esotericism. It opens with proper name symbolism, allusive to the patron deity of alchemy. It features Brand's study of Greek mythology, employs optical imagery. It then speculates upon life's beginnings, and then cites the handbook of Hermetic philosopher and alchemist alike, Plato's discourse, the Timaeus, before finally alluding to the potent alchemical symbol of sun and moon. Brown couldn't spell out his esoteric inclinations louder if he tried. And in his quest to supply evidence of the Qinghang's pattern to his reader, he indulges in a kaleidoscope of topics. Architecture, Bible scholarship, Egyptology, mythology, gardening and plantations in antiquity, geometry, ancient world sculpture, coins, pastimes and games, including chess, backgammon, knucklestones, archery, skittles, paving stones, battle formations, the camera obscura, acoustics, zoology, astronomy, the Kabbalah, and not least in its central chapter, botany. Amusingly, Brown just can't resist mentioning his favourite recent reading in the Garden of Cyrus, the pyramids and mummies and hieroglyphs of ancient Egypt depicted in Kircher's Oedipus Egypticus must have fascinated him. He just can't resist mentioning the Bembine tablet, a Roman artifact which depicts Egyptian gods, which is reproduced in Oedipus Egypticus. And he mentions the Bembine tablet not once, but twice in Cyrus. And all described upon a two-footed altar, as in the hieroglyphics of the brazen temple table of Bembus, will hardly decline all thought of Christian signality in them. The key phrase here is, will hardly decline all thought of Christian signality. It's a classic example of how Hermetic philosophers such as Brown Christianized pagan civilizations to be little more than predictors of the coming of Christ. And Brown's objective here is identical to Kircher's, to reconcile the wisdom of pagan antiquity to Christianity. And in essence, Hermetic philosophies such as Brown and Kircher justified the study of pre-Christian cultures in precisely the same way as the Renaissance scholars Ficino and Mirandola, through a syncretic perspective, by giving credence to a Priscia Theologia, or single theology, one which threaded through all religions and whose wisdom was believed to be passed down in a golden chain of mystics and prophets. These included Zoroaster, the Greek philosophers Pythagoras and Plato, and the biblical figures of Solomon and Moses. For devout Christians, the prophet Moses in particular was a strong link in this golden chain because he had been bred up in the hieroglyphical schools of the Egyptians, as Brown puts it. But above all others, it was the mythic Hermes Trismegistus who was revered by Hermetic philosopher and alchemist alike as the wisest of all pagan prophets. Modern scholarship has now determined Hermes Trismegistus to be a composite figure of the Egyptian god Thoth and the ancient Greek god of revelation, Hermes. Christianity simply appropriated Hermetic teachings for their own agenda and proposed that Hermes Trismegistus was simply a visionary pagan who'd anticipated the coming of Christ. Among the many new words which are found in Cyrus, perhaps it's the word network, as in meaning an artificial structure, which stands out as one of Brown's greatest contributions to our modern technological age. The penultimate paragraph of the Garden of Cyrus has been described as one of the most beautiful pieces of prose ever penned, not only in the 17th century, but in all English literature. In it, Brown meanders in his thoughts on sleep, memory, smell, and dreams. But the quincunx of heaven runs low, and 'tis time to close the five ports of knowledge. We are unwilling to spin out our awaking thoughts into the phantasms of sleep, which often continueth precogitations, making cables of cobwebs and wildernesses of handsome groves. Besides, Hippocrates hath spoke so little, and the dream analysis masters have left such frigid interpretations from plants, that there is little encouragement to dream of paradise itself. Nor will the sweetest delight of gardens afford much comfort in sleep, wherein the dullness of that sense shakes hands with delectable odours. And though in the bed of Cleopatra can hardly with any delight raise up the ghost of a rose. According to his friend, the Reverend Whitefoot, Brown suffered from the psychological trait known as blushing, and he was known to blush sometimes without any apparent cause. So, when King Charles II visited Norwich in 1671 and knighted him at St Andrew's Hall with a full court and civic dignitaries in attendance, he may well have arisen from his knees as Sir Thomas with a face the colour of beetroot. Sometimes later in 1670, Brown wrote his essay known as Christian Morals. It's an essay which includes a fair amount of optical imagery. The language of optics readily lends itself to imagery involving morality and phrases such as to be in the dark, to be reflective, or to be enlightened. All connect optics with states of ignorance and awareness. Imagery involving darkness and light can be found in the spiritual literature of all the world's major religions. In Christian Morals, Brown speculates upon how animals may view us, and he advises us against being overcritical in our view of others. Even beauty is diminished when it's too critically viewed, he warns. Faces look uniformly unto our eyes. How they appear unto some animals of a more piercing or different sight, who are able to discover the inequalities, rubs, and hairiness of the skin, is not without good doubt. And therefore, in reference unto man, Cupid is said to be blind. Affection should not be too sharp-sighted, and love is not to be made by magnifying glasses. Brown's sense of humour was undiminished in his old age. Long before Monty Python's comedy sketch of a dead or pining Norwegian blue parrot, he cracked his own parrot joke. If Cardan says that a parrot is a beautiful bird, Scaliger will set his wits on work to prove it is a deformed animal. It's from his interest in physiognomy, with its esoteric teaching of outer appearance corresponding to inner value, that one of Brown's most impressive new words is introduced in Christian Morals, that of caricature, meaning to represent with exaggerated features, especially facial. Through his maintaining of a medical practice at Norwich for over 30 years, Brown acquired a reputation as being a well-educated, yet modest, devout and morally upright doctor who was trusted and respected throughout the city. But even before his death in 1682, his reputation had already travelled far beyond Norfolk. Copies of his Religio Medici were among the treasured possessions of those who sailed across the Atlantic to begin a new life in the American colonies. It may have been the romantic poet Coleridge who was one of the first to recognise the psychological aspects of Brown, and he writes in his notebooks and waxes lyrical on Brown like this. He looked at his own soul with a telescope. What seemed all irregular, he saw and showed to be beautiful constellations. And he added to the consciousness, hidden worlds within worlds. Coleridge's verse in awe of Thomas Brown includes one of the earliest recorded usages of the word consciousness. Now, by the strangest of coincidences, Coleridge's verse was chosen by Anelia Jaffe, a co-worker of the Swiss psychoanalyst Carl Jung, as homage to the recently deceased psychologist. Coleridge's verse on Brown can be found heading the introduction to Jung's autobiography, Memories, Dreams, Reflections. It was in all probability the South African traveller and explorer, Laurens van der Post, who introduced Brown's thought to Carl Jung. Van der Post quoted to Jung one of Brown's greatest psychological observations. It celebrates the mystery of consciousness and uses proper place symbolism. Brown declares, "We carry within us the wonders we seek without us. There is all Africa and her prodigies in us." Van der Post noted of Jung's reaction to this. He was deeply moved. He wrote it down and exclaimed, "That was and is just it. but it needed the Africa without to drive home the point in my own self. It isn't known whether Carl Jung ever read Villaggio Medici, but he was fond of quoting its title, and once stated, "For the educated person who studied alchemy as part of his general education, it was a real Villaggio Medici." Carl Jung was one of the founding fathers of psychoanalysis. He broke away from his mentor Sigismund Freud, the discoverer of the unconscious psyche, to develop his own psychology, one which was heavily based upon symbolism. Because in Jung's view, symbols express psychic processes far better than any concept. Now, the sources of Brown's symbolism are varied. The Bible and mythology were two happy hunting grounds for his place name symbolism. He uses geographic proper names also. For example, in Pseudodoxia, he describes his endeavours as often fain to wander in the America and untravelled parts of truth. And Brown's usage of the geographic proper place name of Africa to symbolise the hidden within certainly impressed Jung. Carl Jung helpfully explains, "The language of the alchemists is at first sight very different from our psychological terminology and way of thinking. Even in the Middle Ages, confessed alchemists interpreted their symbols in a moral and philosophical sense. Their philosophy was indeed nothing but projected psychology." A great example of how Brown's symbolism and Jung's psychology are related can be seen in one particular symbol. The double-faced god Janus, who simultaneously presents his two faces to the past and the future, pops up in every single one of Brown's writings. The double-faced god clearly held symbolic significance to him. Human consciousness, just like Janus, simultaneously faces both the past and the future. And for this reason, Carl Jung declared Janus to be none other than a perfect symbol of the psyche. The inner world of dreams is also integral to Brown's proto-psychology. For most people, dreams are involuntary, a sequence of strange events and unfamiliar places which are out of one's control and which simply happen to one whilst asleep. Thomas Brown, however, claimed to be able to manipulate the sequence of events in a dream at will, and he describes his ability to lucid dream in Villaggio Medici thus: "Yet in one dream I can compose a whole comedy, behold the action, apprehend the jests, and laugh myself awake at the conceits thereof." For those living in the grim times of the 17th century, the gift of lucid dreaming must have been a welcome diversion. And Brown's ability to lucid dream, in tandem with his wide reading, must have been rich nourishment for his artistic imagination. Included among Brown's miscellaneous writings, there's even a short essay on dreams, and in it, he speculates on the causes and effects of dreams and how they can be interpreted. "Many dreams are made out by sagacious exposition and made by symbolical adaptation, hold a ready way to read the characters of Morpheus." Brown's proposal that dreams can be interpreted by symbolical adaptation links him once more to Jung's analytical psychology. Now, Jung studied and borrowed from Hermetic philosopher and alchemist alike in the development of his psychology, and foremost of all symbols in his psychology are those of the archetypes, the primordial moulds of the psyche, which he believed are embedded at the deepest layers of our collective psyche, and some of the most important are the hero, the lover, the great mother, the wise ruler, and the trickster. Now, not only does one of the earliest usages of the word archetype occur in the Garden of Cyrus, but Brown even attempts, through his proper name symbolism, to outline a specific archetype, that of the wise ruler. And he names the Persian king Cyrus, the Hebrew figures of Solomon and Moses, the Roman emperor Augustus, and the Greek Alexander the Great as examples of the archetype. The archetype of the fertile Great Mother is also tentatively sketched by him through proper name allusion to the matriarchal figures of Sarah in the Old Testament, the Greek goddess Juno, and the ancient Egyptian goddess Isis. Another great example of how Brown's proto-psychology anticipates Jungian psychology occurs at the apotheosis of Cyrus, where he urges his reader to search out the quaternios. Now, this is advice which Jung took very seriously. He believed the quaternity, or patterns of four, to invariably symbolise totality. And indeed, our earliest known divisions of space and time, the four seasons of the year, the four points of the compass, as well as the four Gospels of the New Testament, all form a quaternity. Jung even based his psychology upon a quaternity, and he defined the human mind as consisting of four entities, these being rational thinking, feeling, sensation, intuition, and the nebulous term of intuition. So, in conclusion, I'm suggesting Brown is a philosopher who's far more interested in the Renaissance discovery of the psyche than in the discoveries of either the telescope or the microscope. This is because it's not science, but spirituality and psychic processes such as self-realization and individuation, which are Brown's primary concern. His only science of any value today is the science of the mind, and I'm fairly confident that he would have agreed with Carl Jung's assessment of our modern day world. Science and technology have indeed conquered the world. But whether the psyche has gained anything is another matter. Today, Sir Thomas Brown can confidently be identified as a proto or early psychologist. His self-analysis, deep interest in people, usage of symbolism, and fascination with dreams are all vital components of his proto-psychology. And though he lacked in terminology, he nonetheless attempted to describe the psyche through symbolism and imagery such as the theatre of ourselves. But perhaps Brown's greatest achievement as a proto-psychologist is simply the fact that he introduced into English words which are useful to his profession, and they include medical, pathology, hallucination, and best of all, therapeutic. Furthermore, as I hope I've adequately demonstrated, Brown's proto-psychology has a unique relationship to one of the founding fathers of psychoanalysis, Carl Jung, and his archetypal psychology.